Okay, so reminder to everybody that we're recorded and we're likely to end up on the internet, so please don't say things that will embarrass you in front of your grandchildren. The topic I want to address tonight is there a modern Orthodox way to decide halakha? And I want to be clear that I'm asking it as a question. And I'm asking it as a question both because I'm not sure whether there is whether the answer to it is yes. And secondly, because it should not be so clear that we have a strong rooting interest in the answer being yes. It is possible to construct a viable Orthodox movement without having a distinctive approach to halakha. I'm not aware, for example, of the Musar movement's approach to halakha, specifically its approach to deciding halakha as a distinctive move. And there are real risks in developing unique approaches to halakha, specifically if you get to the point where you no longer communicate with the other halakhic communities, that's how you get sectarianism, when halakhic conversation no longer exists across various groups within the same denomination, so to speak, whatever the term you want to use. So it's not 100% clear that the answer is yes, or that the answer should be yes. I'm going to start on the premise that it would be better in some ways if the answer were yes, but I want to be clear that if the answer is yes, it should be yes in a qualified sense, in that there are aspects of halachic decision-making that are distinctive to modern orthodoxy, but it doesn't mean that every aspect of halachic decision-making is distinctive to modern orthodoxy. It would be important to point out that whatever community you identify with, whatever broader community you identify with, there's much overlap, but there are these things which we do differently, because I think it would be unwise to try and create modern Orthodox halakha as a hermetically sealed space, which is impervious to influences that are not modern Orthodox. Second question you have to ask, when you say, is there an X way to decide halakha, so X being modern Orthodox as opposed to what? Right, modern Orthodoxy as opposed to what other kinds of ways of deciding halakha? Now, to my knowledge, nobody has yet launched a really serious comparison between modern Orthodox and Hasidic decision making, halachically, right? That's not a conversation. So usually, when we talk about modern Orthodox decision making, we're talking about distinguishing it, on the one hand, from what we could call Haredi halachic decision making, on the other hand, what you might call conservative halachic decision making. And it makes a big difference as to which of those distinctions matter most to you. I think last year, at Shari Tzvila Newton, I gave a Shabbat drasha, the topic of Behillah Beit Shammai and Eilu Ve'ilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, and I tended to focus there on the Behillah Beit Shammai model as modern Orthodoxy and Haredi Judaism, and you have to maintain the conversation and quote each other, Eilu Ve'ilu, and afterwards Rabbi Danny Lehman came over to me and said he thought I had it all wrong, right? Why is it that the conversation partners I was looking for were on the right as opposed to on the left? So I want to acknowledge up front that you could do it either way, and I tend to stand by my position, which is that I think that the primary halachic conversation from modern Orthodoxy is to its right as opposed to its left. But even if one is interested in having that conversation, which means that tonight I'm most interested in the distinctions between modern Orthodoxy and what we'll call the right as opposed to modern Orthodoxy and we might call further to its left, we also have to constantly acknowledge, even then, that there's a polemical context, that part of being in conversation with the right is constantly saying, "We're different than the left." there's always a need to distinguish yourself at both ends. Okay, so how would we go about deciding the question? So the first way of doing it, I think, is the most authoritative way, is to go to Wikipedia. Here's what Wikipedia says about halachic decision making, Orthodoxy, modern, right, Haredi Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy, conservative Judaism. So Orthodox Judaism has a range of opinions on the circumstances and extent to which change is permissible. Haredi Jews generally hold that even minhagim, customs, must be retained, and existing precedents cannot be reconsidered. Modern Orthodox authorities are generally more inclined to permit limited changes in customs and some reconsideration of precedent. Right, so that's their distinction between Haredi and modern Orthodox is, right, some limited change in custom and some reconsideration of precedent. On the other hand, a key difference between conservative and Orthodox approaches is that conservative Judaism holds that its rabbinical body's powers are not limited to reconsidering later precedents based on earlier sources, but that the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards is empowered to override biblical and Tannaitic prohibitions by Takana, when perceived to be inconsistent with modern requirements and our views of ethics. Now, the distinctions between Haredi and modern Orthodox Judaism is kind of vague and makes everything a matter of degree, which can be quite unsatisfying. Just say, well, we're a little bit more open to changing custom and a little bit more open to reconsideration of precedent. Furthermore, I think it's really not so true. So I'll tell a joke that many of you have heard from me before, but I think it's worth memorizing and repeating for many of your friends, which are, there are two complaints that people always make. You always hear about the way halakha, non-modern Orthodox halakha, exists in the world today. The first is that it's absolutely frozen, and nobody's willing to introduce any changes, right? You know, even minhagim customs must be retained, and existing precedents cannot be reconsidered. The second thing that we can't stand are all the new chumras. Where did all these new stringencies come from? Nobody ever kept them. Right? Nobody ever did these things before. Nobody checked for bugs that way. Nobody. Now you just think about it and you say, uh-oh, they contradict each other. Right? You can't both say that you're upset about the freezing of halakha and that you're upset about all the new chumras. Right? Because all the new chumras are changed. So the perception is not that halakha has been unchanged, that the Haredi community is unchanging, rather that the Haredi community in fact makes many changes. And I don't think that we would want to define the modern Orthodox approach to halakha as we're willing to make a few more changes as long as they're lakula, right? As long as they're lenient, but we're not willing to consider anything that creates astringency. That doesn't seem to me to be a viable self-respecting approach. Secondly, right, if we see the reality that in fact Haredi halakha has changed dramatically, and really the only difference is perhaps that they're better at disguising their changes than we have been, which we'll talk about at the CMTL conference this August, what it means to construct yourself as part of a tradition. So then that's not a basic for distinction. And furthermore, I think that we need to understand that the whole notion of a halakha, which is an inflexible continuation of the past, is a fiction. There are two simple ways of demonstrating that. One is, what is the halakha which is a direct continuation of the past regarding electricity? Can't be. There wasn't any, right? There wasn't such a thing. So you can't talk about it. The second thing is, when you talk about the inflexibility of custom, so the inflexibility of customs are local and geographic and relate to specific people and communities. But we have such a strong Balshuva population, and we have people have traced the breakdown of geographic minhag to World War I. In the aftermath of World War II, everyone has moved. So how many of the people who are supposedly following inflexible custom are following the customs their parents did? Very few. So the notion that one vision of halakha is unchanging, and what would make modern Orthodoxy distinct is its openness to change, seems to me to be wholly inaccurate with regard to what is not modern Orthodox, let alone with the question of whether modern Orthodoxy is actually flexible. To me, the metaphor for this is the Art Scroll Talmud. Now, the Art Scroll Talmud is often depicted as if it were the bastion of traditionalism, and specifically, right, what made the Art Scroll Talmud the bastion of traditionalism as opposed to the Steinfeld Talmud is that Art Scroll maintained the sacred Tzuret Hadaf of the Vilna Talmud. Right? Many of you have heard of it. Right? The classic traditional yeshiva page of the Talmud, and that demonstrates a certain amount of lowercase conservatism. Now, first of all, the notion of popularizing Talmud to the point where people with no yeshiva education, no access, right, no direct tradition to from teachers, where Talmud becomes wholly open to democratic study, where, let's say, a very bright 12-year-old girl can start learning Talmud on her own, and become highly competent learning Talmud, right? That is a direct result of Art Scroll. Could not have happened before, and it revolutionizes the community. Right? The second thing is, it's not true that Art Scroll maintains the Vilna Shas. Art Scroll actually uses a reprinting of the Talmud called the Oz V'Hadar edition, a very fine edition that graphically is very much like the Vilna Shas, but includes all sorts of commentaries that were never there in Vilna. Actually edits the text in the text inside it. And is a wonderful, beautiful modern update. And that, to me, is a good metaphor for the notion that the distinction between modern Orthodoxy and Haredi Judaism is one of change as opposed to non-change. It might be about different kinds of change. It might be about the ways in which change is presented, but it's not about, right, it's not about change per se. And on the other hand, I don't think that it's necessarily true that we want to limit the differences between modern Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism to extreme cases of takanot. First of all, it's not clear that we want to be in principle opposed to the possibility of takanot in modern Orthodoxy. There might be certain areas where, if we could actually get a consensus, we'd be all in favor. Right? If the right rabbis got together of creating takanot, often talk about how Rav Yitzchak Herzog, the first chief rabbi of Israel, and wrote a halachic constitution for the state of Israel, a hypothetical, and never got started, and it began with a list of the takanot you would have to make. About inheritance and inheritance and testimony and minority rights and all sorts of things like that. So to form our position on that ground is, I think, not so strong. Or to take a case that in certain parts of the modern Orthodox community has real significance. So there is a tshuva of the Sridi H of Yisrael Weinberg, which is very famous about the permissibility of mixed zemirot in youth groups, in which in the tshuva, he articulates that the reason that one of the reasons in which he permits it is Eit la'asot la'Hashem eferet Torahtecha. This is necessary to prevent assimilation. Now, I don't actually think, I used to be agnostic about this, but now I'm fairly convinced. Mark Shapiro sent me a collection of a collection of the letters of Yisrael Weinberg, in which it's clear that Rav Weinberg didn't actually say this because he thought it was a total breach of halakha. He was actually just believed himself to be continuing the standard German custom. Right? He didn't think it was a break at all. But he was afraid the Eastern Europeans would attack him, so he said, you know what? But sometimes you have to make takanot. Now, right? So the notion that in principle we should be opposed to takanot and we should define ourselves on the basis of opposition to takanot seems to me to be unwise. Takanot is a explicit rabbinic decree which makes law, as opposed to interpreting law. Thank you. Now, I think that a more stark way of framing it is that I don't think that we necessarily want to make the axis which defines our halachic decision-making change. Right? That the only thing which distinguishes us is when we want to change precedent, right? Because change is always, right? Change is always radical and rare. Right? Really, the heart of halacha is how it continues and grows naturally. And so if we want to define what our decision-making process should be, we should be able to define it in ways that relate to the ordinary halachic process and not just to the extreme cases where halacha seems to be, or where some people think halacha is in crisis and you have to change it. And then really, ideally, the notion is that in the extreme cases, you're just continuing a process that you go all the way through as opposed to abrogating your normal procedures all of a sudden and saying, this is what we usually do, this is an emergency procedure. That tends not, I think, to work very effectively. Okay, so what are other axes along which one might choose to distinguish halachic process? So one very simple way is that halachic process is defined by who you quote and how often you quote them. Right? So you might say that what defines modern Orthodoxy, in a sense, is that you quote the Rav a lot. And to not be modern Orthodox is to never quote the Rav, and there's a between things like the Art Scroll Chumash where you quote the Rav once. And certainly, I don't know a psak emerging from the Haredi community, which makes any reference to the Rav Talachic positions, which largely, as you know, exist only orally, although now there's a book by Arnold Ziegler, which is Halachic Positions of Rabbi Soloveitchik, three different volumes which collect all the Rav's detailed positions, but I don't see them having much market penetration in the world of Haredi Psak for one reason or another. Shechter has Nefesh HaRav, but all these works, I think, have penetration exclusively in the modern Orthodox community. So you could define a community entirely by who you quote and how often. And on the converse side, and this is a conversation I had with a conservative rabbi who very much aspires to bring the more halachic wing of conservative Judaism into the Orthodox framework. And so a reverse side is to say that what defines you as modern Orthodox as opposed to conservative is whether you cite the positions of past conservative rabbis as precedent at all. Right? One of the distinguishing social characteristic is that to cite a position of the community and Jewish law and standards as meaningful precedent in a tshuva is automatically be excluded from orthodoxy. Right? We have, you know, as always, we have marginal cases, right? Can you quote Professor Lieberman? Right, things like that. But on the whole, you could draw fairly bright lines in practice between Haredi Judaism, modern orthodoxy, and conservative Judaism based entirely on who you quote. But this, to me, doesn't seem to me a sufficient or desirable description. Although it is, I have to say, right, it is often an accurate description. Because I think when you have a clear vision and you're identified with something, so then it's true that over time, when you say, I quote these people because, then over time you tend to become much more attached to their accidental positions. Right? If a tradition grows up that says, you know what, we tend to quote the postgame who believe X or who work in the following way, and it happens that all those postgame, for some entirely incidental reason, believe that you can brush your teeth with toothpaste on Shabbat, as opposed to those who don't. Or vice versa, right? They believe you can't brush your teeth with toothpaste on Shabbos because of a discussion about, you know, how exactly we treat the foaming action of toothpaste when you brush it. So it might be over time you develop accidental positions. I argue that that's really what Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are, that people try and come up with these vast explanations that account for every detail of the disputes between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, because why would all the people in Beit Hillel always hold this, and why would all the people in Beit Shammai always hold that? I think the answer is no. There probably was at some core an ideological dispute, which we can't really track down now. And then over time, they just started quoting each other. And so positions hardened on accidental issues. So Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai have disputes about toothpaste, which have nothing whatsoever to do about the ideologies of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. It's just if you belong to Beit Hillel, you quoted your precedents. If you belong to Beit Shammai, you quoted your precedents. But in order to get, but for that to happen, and that's the only thing that distinguishes you, right, that to me doesn't sound like a basis for a community. Might call it that defines a post-ideological community, right, a community which no longer has ideas, but right is only following precedent. It just happens that its past ideas led to certain kinds of precedents. Okay, there's a second way in which you can distinguish not by personality, not by who you quote, but just by saying that the psak of this community works on the premise that certain kinds of results are true, right? You can't, right? And right, if you want to be this kind of suck, then you have to say that X is an outcome, right? And there are certain outcomes that probably we could identify as if only a posek within modern orthodoxy would say X, and a posek, right? Only a posek within the Haredi community would say Y. So we could, define modern Orthodox psak as opposed to Haredi psak as one which is more liberal. A modern Orthodox psak is one which would be much more liberal about the issue of what amount of their hair married women have to cover. Define it on the other hand by saying that a modern Orthodox tshuva works on the presumption that all forms of homosexual contact are forbidden. And you could define it that way. But leaving aside whether there is enough content in those grounds to distinguish you, the problem with that is that it limits you entirely to the past and tells you nothing about how to proceed in the future. It just says, right, a modern Orthodox psak is anything which accepts these premises, right, these past outcomes, and a Haredi or conservative psak is one which accepts, which works as a given these outcomes. If a new case comes along, it doesn't tell you what to do, and if you don't have an animating ideology, it doesn't get you anywhere. So I'll give you, you know, what to me is an interesting example. Many of you know, right, there is a controversy about how to handle the sabbatical year, the Shemitah, in Israel, in which the religious Zionist position for years was that you engage in a sale of the land to non-Jews in some fashion. The Israeli Rabbanut backed away from that during the last Shemitah cycle, and as a result, the new Orthodox rabbinic group called Tohar, we had Rabbi Stav, who is one of the founders here earlier this year, to step in for the Rabbanut to engage in that sale. And in general, that was seen as a divider, which also matched the lines of modern Orthodoxy in America, where most of modern Orthodoxy in America believed that it was necessary to engage, to support the Heter Mechira, albeit sometimes by holding your nose, because it's a scary thing to say that the settlement of the land of Israel requires you to sell the land of Israel. Right? Really, in order to maintain the land of Israel in Jewish hands, we have to sell it to non-Jews for a year. Right? It's a difficult position to take, but it's a position that we've been taking for 100 years or so. But then the interesting thing was that across the kosher certification world, however it may be, nobody in America allowed Israeli produce in. For various halachic reasons, nobody allowed, right, the OU did not allow, right, did not allow Israeli produce in any of its restaurants. We didn't at the KVH. So on the one hand, the old psak was maintained, but on the question of whether the real issue was, you know, making agriculture in Israel viable, and nobody had any resources for handling that. Take away the whole export, right? The whole Jewish export market. Very strange outcome. I don't have a better outcome. To say that how one handles Shemitah is an area which I think right now is, and this is not my, you know, my original idea. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has said it is entirely, really explicitly that that Shemitah right now is a halachic disaster area according to anybody. Nobody believes the outcome we have is what halakha is supposed to accomplish, right? Where the outcome is either the impossibility of agriculture, or the sale of the land, right? Or the sale of the land to non-Jews, right? None of those is what. And if you think that the original purpose of Shemitah was to create some kind of economic equality, right? Where instead, right? And right, instead, what it does is it reduces you have a certain group of farmers who, instead of being self-sustaining, have to ask for charity all the time, right? And has no impact whatsoever on the broader society. Shemitah is one of the areas where we, the rabbinic community, who are responsible for halakha, have failed. And, this is not one of which I can critique from outside, because I have absolutely nothing to say, which is better than anything that exists. We should be able to do something better, and we haven't. Okay. But I don't think, but the point is that limiting you to outcomes of the past doesn't, right, unless you understand why you support those outcomes in the past, and what those outcomes represent, doesn't tell you anything about the future, and it certainly doesn't tell you anything about a process. It just might give you guesses as to what the outcomes might be. Okay, so what might be methodological issues that distinguished modern Orthodox Psak? So one possibility is attitude toward science. I might say that modern Orthodox Psak is much more likely to be friendly to science. So here I'm going to say, and I know that this is not a popular position in this community always, that actually I tend to think that if modern Orthodox Psak has a relationship to science, it will be more skeptical rather than less in the Haredi community. Then on the whole, when it comes to halakha, Haredi psak, I think, is actually much more accepting of whatever the standard scientific consensus is right now, because in large measure, and this is a stereotype, but what you have is the notion that science is this foreign body of knowledge which you have to accept when it impinges on halakha. There's some areas, the scientists get to determine what the science is. When you have specific traditions that seem to make that problematic, and this occurs much more often in the realm of theology than in the realm of halakha, so then you might have a desire, not a skepticism about science, but a rejection of science. But I think I think the difference between poskim who see their bailiwick as exclusively halakha, but recognize that sometimes science is necessary for that, and poskim who see themselves as existing in both worlds, is that poskim who see themselves existing in both worlds are more likely to be skeptical of the world of science, because they're not likely to take it on faith, because they'll say, I understand this. I understand its limits, I understand its risks, and things like that. And I think if you follow, you'll discover that except for areas where there is a clear conflict between some kind of traditional position and contemporary science, I think you will tend to find that the more Haredi the psak, the less skeptical it is of whatever the standard scientific consensus is, with occasional circumstances in which you unfortunately get taken in by cranks because you have the one scientist you call.
You're talking really more in terms of practical
issues
like medicine.
Sure.
Technology.
Not talking about evolution, age of the universe, right? Because those don't impact halakha so much. There are weird cases where they impact halakha, like if you want to invalidate all rabbinic court judges for conversion cases who believe the world is more than 6,000 years old, right? So there are places where that comes into play. But in a normal, right, in normal halakha, when you're deciding medical issues, right, or things like that, I tend to think actually that a metaphor of this might be the dispute about electric shavers, right? Or electric shavers considered shaving the razor or not. So famously in YU for years, this is the Lidman Orthodoxy, we'll talk in a moment, Rav Schechter allowed, Rav Schechter forbade them, and although Rav Schechter changed his mind many, many times, and Rav Willig, we always had to ask somebody what he had said yesterday, and Rav Willig allowed them, and the raid in YU was that was because Rav Schechter believed the ads, and Rav Willig didn't. that's right, so people, right, so if you live in the world where you see advertisements, you understand that advertisements, right, are often just not true. Right, the more distance you are from that, the more likely. I'm not, saying that necessarily about Rav Schechter, but I tend to think that, right, the notion that the Haredi world is resistant to science and halakha, and the modern Orthodox world is accepting, really needs to be qualified greatly. I don't think there's any community which is resistant to science per se in halakha, although I think there's some people who are, right, who will get their backs up when it seems that halakha is directly contradicting something, some Gemara somewhere. But any area that isn't directly contradicted, I don't think there's much difference. If there is a difference, I tend to think that modern Orthodox poskim will be more likely to exercise independent judgment about what the science is, rather than accepting whatever the consensus is, whereas people for whom science is foreign are more likely to say, well, we have a halakhic rule, which is you follow the majority, so tell me what the majority of, right, what the majority of science, of engineers say, and we're just going to follow that. Okay, another possible approach is attitude towards manuscript or archaeological evidence, where you might think that modern Orthodoxy would be much more open to the use of, right, to the use of manuscripts from that are recently found or to archaeological evidence. Now here, this is one of the issues we have, is that there's sort of an anomaly that the official modern Orthodox position has always been really, really resistant to allowing these things to have an impact on halakha, and a lot of this has to do simply, and this is an issue we have to address methodologically, with the personality of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Right? So the Rav was very much into a, right, at least in his ideological statements, as opposed to his actual psak, which I'm not competent to talk about, which I tend to think was different, but in his ideological statements about what halakha was, he tended to oppose any notion of locating halakha historically, and notions of change, really, in that kind of sense. And so I don't think there has been, until recently, any movement in modern Orthodoxy to be more accepting, and probably be less accepting. Most of the manuscripts of the Rishonim we have are printed by Haredim, and they actually make their way into Haredi Psak, unless it becomes an ideological issue like the Meiri, where a false statement that the Meiri was a manuscript unearthed as opposed to something that had always existed in the tradition tended to polarize people's statements around issues of non-Jews. But in general, let's say, can you find a Haredi posek who doesn't quote the Ritva? Now, nobody knew about the Ritva. The Ritva is not mentioned by the Beit Yosef, not quoted in the Beit Yosef. Basically, hard to find the Ritva in the halachic tradition before the 20th century. Nobody in the Haredi world cares. So the notion of that really is the boundary seems to me very hard to sustain, although right now it is interesting that there are a number of poskim who we might call in the modern Orthodox community who have begun changing that. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who is Rosh Hashiva Shivat Malay Adumim, is very, very much into using historical reconstruction of manuscripts and recovering original meanings of text. Rav Henkin in Israel is very into that, and truthfully, Rav Herschel Schechter has very explicitly endorsed when said things like, if you understand what the pshat is, you have the right manuscript. Why would you possibly paskin even if it's been a halacha for 500 years, he's perfectly happy to overturn the past 500 years if you can prove to him that, right, that the manuscripts were wrong. It's actually very, very radical that way. But certainly that's not how you train poskim in YU. Right, of course, in order to come to the tzak, first you have to go look at the manuscripts of the Gemara and see what the girsolos are. I think there's one shear in YU that does that. What about how we learn and the way in which you analyze Talmud? So on the whole, modern Orthodoxy, again, because of the legacy of the Rav, we're just pretty traditional briskers. We learn with a particular conceptual model, which is otherwise identified with a fairly extreme form of Lithuanian Haredi Judaism, as opposed to other methods which are. I don't think the conceptual method has any specific reason that it should be connected to modern Orthodoxy. It's a historical accident. So I don't think any of those are sufficient. All of these axes, however, raise a critical issue, which is the distinction of prescriptive, whether we're trying to describe what modern Orthodox tzak is, or to prescribe what modern Orthodox tzak should be. And this is always an issue in modern Orthodoxy. You always have the classic distinction between sociological and ideological modern Orthodoxy. Sociological modern Orthodoxy is often described as having somewhat less commitment to halakha, particularly on issues of sexuality. But generally, ideological modern Orthodoxy is committed to visions of women's rights and treatment of non-Jews and issues like that. So which community, right? The psak of which community is an issue. And the problem is that the description and the prescription always intertwine, because the question of who you take as a model, right, descriptively, right. So if I want to say modern Orthodox psak is the psak as it is issued by these people. Well, these people, not those people. Why did I pick these people, not those people? Because I think, even though they all identify with the community, because I want those people to be the right model. So if we look at who our models are, so one problem is that most of our models of modern Orthodox tzak tend to be Israelis. And it's not clear to what degree that really relates to our community. For example, Rita Herzl Henkin, who is a wonderful posik and writer, but how many Americans know any of his positions that aren't related to the role of women? How many? You know, it's a fascinating posik on many issues, right? But I think it'd be hard pressed probably to find 10 or 15, all right, people who've read through Shu'at B'nei Vanu, wonderful sefer, and cite him regularly on issues other than that. Two in this room. Strongly encouraged, right? Strongly encouraged, and available in English on women's issues, right? Response on women's issues is available on English, but his other tshuvot is still only available in Hebrew. We have Rav Shurlo in Yeshivat Petah Tikva, and Rav Gilad and Rav Bigman in Ma'ale Gilboa, and Rav Benny Lau, and Rav Lichtenstein, and perhaps some other poskim in Yeshivat Har Etzion. But the first question is, are Israelis modern Orthodox meaningfully in an American sense, right? Or is there really, the communities really are addressing entirely separate issues? Secondly, even in Israel, they don't all see themselves as part of the same movement. But I asked the Ram from Har Etzion this past summer, you know, do you see yourself as part of the same movement as Ma'ale Gilboa and Petah Tikva? And he said, no. We don't oppose them, but they don't see themselves as part of the same community at all. So what would it mean, you know, to try and build a modern Orthodox commonality among people who don't see the commonality among themselves is a big issue. And in America, right, so who are the modern Orthodox poskim? So my teacher of Mordechai Willig, certainly, and of Herschel Schechter, and Tzvi Sabalevsky, who's written a wonderful book on Nida, and you can buy the book, or you can listen to his even better lectures on Hilchot Nida, which I, you know, with my joy in the car this spring, was listening to all 20 hours of his theorem in Hilchot Nida, at the end of which you have a really beautiful, clear picture of Hilchot Nida, highly recommended, or an hour and a half, and you can learn how to build a mikveh. Even more fun if you had I hope that someone has an audio video presentation where you can actually see the model he's holding up. But an hour and a half, wonderfully, wonderfully clear. You couldn't possibly view them as Haredi. First of all, they quote the Rav all the time, and right on all sorts of other issues. The sensibilities are clearly modern Orthodox. Presumption that you're going to college, value of college education, all sorts of issues like that. And yet, I don't know if. I don't know if we would view them as methodological models. On the other hand, right, you know, if you start getting into definition the other way, if you say, well, what I want to be a methodological model is Rabbi Daniel Sperber, or Mendel Shapiro, who wrote, right? So then it ends up that issues of methodology actually become subordinated to issues of outcome. Because there again, the only tshuvot that people know are the specific tshuvot that implement changes or allow practices that they care about deeply, and the notion that anybody has heard about their positions about what type of detergent you should use in your dishwasher on Shabbos or something like that, right, it's deeply unlikely that anybody has heard about it or would care very much if the mode by which they reached that approach was, right, what halachic methodology they used to reach that process. Okay, so I'll give you another example of the boundary between prescriptive and descriptive. Here I'm going to quote a paragraph from a very fine young halachic scholar. It goes as follows. Let me emphasize again in closing that the halachic arguments above show that torture can be forbidden, not that it must be. Technical counterclaims can easily be made. For example, one might suggest that the blanket prohibition I described should only be rabbinic, and there is no capacity to legislate rabbinically in our day. What I describe is halakha as I believe it ought to be, and as it can be, if we acknowledge that ethical principles have a critical role to play in both physical war and milchamta shel Torah. Now, that's a clear statement of prescriptive unorthodox halakha, right? One that believes that ethical principles have a critical role to play in both physical war and milchamta shel Torah. It happens to be a quote from me. What's interesting about it is that I wrote it in a response of an old friend of mine, Rabbi Michael Broyd, a very fine, unquestionably important, right, on the substantive sociological level, important monorthodox posik. But I wrote that in response to him, and in fact, I'm told that the admissions interview for Yeshivat Chov Veitara, which certainly on many of these descriptions fits as non-orthodox, is you have to read these two articles and decide which of us you agree with methodologically. So the notion that there is a clear methodological position seems problematic. If here you have two people, I identify as a non-orthodox posik, everyone identifies him as a non-orthodox posik. On many substantive issues, he's a very important non-orthodox posik, and yet it seems that on critical methodological issues, we differ quite dramatically. Okay, right, and we could ask, similar questions about Rabbi Jachter, certainly is an important monorthodox posik who I bring in to speak to my program every summer, and yet we don't agree necessarily on what the methodological issues are all across the board, or others that we've mentioned previously. So, now it may be that the attempt to define a whole set of unifying characteristics and expect everyone to agree with all of them is excessive. What you have really is a cluster of positions, and to be monorthodox, to do monorthodox stock, you have to do three of these five. I'm open to that possibility, but I tend to think that at some level it's going to have to come down to the values that are implemented in the in your halachic decision making, and that's true even though there are some monorthodox poskim whose methodology involves denying the role of values. Nonetheless, I think that monorthodox sock, if it's going to have an identity, is going to have to come down to some question of values. Now, some of these values are, such as religious Zionism, the right of women to full religious experience, and the obligation to treat all human beings, Jewish or non-Jewish, to the fullest ethical extent, are fairly well known, although the boundaries are disputed. And I think it's also important that it's critical that we allow poskim to be countercultural within the community. Right? To say that a posik always has to confirm the values of the community is to undermine the dignity of halakha. Halakha can never critique. But I want to suggest, at least as a starter here, that one possibility, that a key issue is going to be the extent to which a recognition of the value of autonomy plays a role in Psak Halakha. Autonomy, I think, is a central modern value, and I think that you can set out a distinctive vision of halachic process which takes autonomy as a value. Autonomy to some degree is closely related to correlated to certain visions of democracy, republicanism more than democracy. It's not just tyranny of the majority, but a notion that you don't want power to flow only in one direction. And secondly, I think another extension of autonomy is that one can recognize that it means that even when you think you know what the halakha is, you're more respectful of the values of those people who are affected by it, if their values would yield a different outcome. Respectful. Now, you have to be very careful. Autonomy is a challenging and scary notion to introduce in a halakhic setting. The member of Young Israel here who argued with me offhand a while back that autonomy and halakhic authority are incompatible. And authority is an issue in any system that values autonomy. There's a lot of enthusiasm when you talk about autonomy. I remember Rabbi Dov Linzer and I gave a shiur at Eida about 10 years ago. We gave a session on paskening for yourself, I think it was called. And sometimes I get people to turn out, but that was like people spilling out of, right? We had this fairly large room and people were spilling out the windows and banging on the doors and they wanted to be in that. So that seems to be a really, big issue. At the same time, if it turns out that the price of autonomy is the impossibility of authority, I'm not willing to pay that. I think there has to be some notion of halachic authority, both because without authority, I think halakha as a system of law vanishes, and also because we discover, you know, there's a reason that societies always build legal systems, because otherwise you get anarchy, and in anarchy the weak suffer. Very simple illustration of that is that the Agunah crisis is a function. You might argue that the proper solution to it involves intellectual creativity, but there's an easy practical solution to it, which is authority. And the reason we have a crisis is because of the collapse of authority. And I can tell you, our Beit Din often has trouble because we say, you know what, we would like to solve this situation by creating communal pressure, but nobody accepts our authority to do it. And we can't count on that if we tell people that this person is doing something wrong, that they will decide that we have the authority to determine that this person is doing something wrong, and should be should suffer socially as a result. Everyone makes up their own mind, right, and decides, and they don't really have time to decide whether it's right or wrong. So authority goes by the board. And every rabbi has individual autonomy, so there are real costs to autonomy as well. But I want to suggest that if there is going to be a modern Orthodox halachic process, it's going to rest on a recognition of the value set that surrounds autonomy, although we'll have to do it in a way which is responsible and enables us to preserve a conception of halakha as law, and that's a great challenge. So I wanted to spend, about 20 minutes with you, doing a case study in how this plays out, and watching a particular area in which I believe that autonomy became a flashpoint, right, a defining line between a halachic position that was explicitly identified with part of the modern Orthodox camp, and a response which came explicitly in the name of Haredi Judaism. And I think it's worth looking at those two to see both how sometimes people say surprising things when they get stuck in ideological battles, but also to understand both how people see the advantages and risks of autonomy. So the issue I want to address specifically is brain death. I don't know how many of you have followed the great brain death controversy over the past year, great halachic brain death controversy. I don't want to talk about the substance of it, which, you know, if you want, I have a lecture online about that, an article coming out on the substance of what goes on in brain death. But what happened descriptively in terms of the process of Pesach that interests me here is as follows. Rabbi Dov Winter, who's the head of Yeshivat Chovei Torah, the dean of Yeshivat Chovei Torah, and I have to say, since we're doing a political context, I have to say, and an old and dear friend of mine and a valued colleague, so when this dispute, to some degree, it got nasty, and I take clear sides on when it got nasty, but I want to try and evaluate it on the substance. So so what emerged was, there was a report came out of the Rabbinical Council of America which cast doubt on a much earlier position, how arrived at is not our issue right now, in which the Rabbinical Council of America had officially endorsed brain death as a standard of death, and therefore allowed Jews to donate their organs after brain death. A report came out of the Rabbinical Council of America which cast doubt on the basis of that decision, and it was feared, at least, that would encourage people to cease donating. Not clear how many people were donating initially and how many people really cared about whether the RCA changed its position, but the assumption was that significant numbers of people had been donating and that this would change their mind. It's also a given that while there was a limited, many people certainly were not donating and using halachic opposition to brain death as their ground for not doing so, that there was no similar reluctance about accepting organs from other people who were brain dead, especially if those other people were not Jewish. So Rabbi Linzer, in response to this, put out a public petition, which he asked other rabbis to sign on the issue. This is the first page of the Makorah packet. Right. So he said, "We, the undersigned Orthodox rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva, affirm the following principles with regard to organ donation and brain stem death." Right, so first of all, he says that the Halachic definition of death is a long-standing debate amongst Gedolei Yisrael, and we should not mention that many people, including Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, are proponents of the position that brain stem death constitutes the, or at least a halachic definition of death. So both positions are halachically viable. I should say, because I know there have been rumors to the contrary, that Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz does in fact hold this position very strongly, at least so he maintained in an extended telephone conversation with me. So I can see that without personal aegis that he really does hold this, because for a while there was an attempt to cast doubt on that. And hold it in a very sophisticated, nuanced way. So the first thing that Rabbi Linzer said was that there's a machloket a poskim and there are great poskim on both sides. All right, so therefore, he says, brainstem death is a halachically operational definition of death, and therefore it is permitted to have organs removed. Right, so far what we're saying is there are two viable halachic positions, and you're entitled to poskim like one of them. Okay, now he goes on. He says that in light of the serious moral issues and profound life-saving potential presented by the possibility of organ donations, we strongly recommend that the rabbis who are rendering decisions for the laity in this matter demonstrate a strong predisposition to accept the halachic view of the Gedolei HaPoskim who define the moment of halachic death to be that of brainstem death, or that they refer their laity to rabbis who do so. Now that was a fascinating paragraph. I'm not sure whether there's a precedent in halachic literature for a paragraph quite like that. So we should look at it really closely together. Right. He says that it's a machloket, right? We already said it's a machloket, there's a dispute. Both sides are legitimate. But now he says, right, but because there are serious moral issues involved here, and this is and he says profound life-saving potential, right? Again, if I were discussing the substance, we might think, or profound life-taking potential, right? But he has a side he's taking, right? Profound life-saving potential. Therefore, what do you do with rabbis who are paskening for lay people? Demonstrate a strong predisposition. Now, what does that mean? Why shouldn't they just paskin? Right? Demonstrate a strong predisposition. Right? What does that mean halachically? So here's what I think Rabbi Linzer is saying. You know what? There is this, right? There's this huge machloket amongst the poskim. You know what? There are a lot of rabbis who are going to look at you and say, who am I to make a decision when there are these great poskim? Rabbi Yashiv says no, and Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz says yes, whatever you're picking the side, who am I to make a decision? So what are those rabbis to do? So what he says is, because there are moral issues and profound life-saving potential, and the way Rabbi Linzer sets this up is, there is a halachic stalemate, but it's clear to him which way the moral weight of the argument is. It's clear to him that if you were deciding the issue on a moral basis, you would decide it in favor of accepting brain death. But on a formal halachic level, there's a standoff of authority. So what do you do if you're a rabbi? You don't paskin because you can't make the decision in areas. You tell your lay people that I can't paskin this, but if I were to paskin this, I would much rather the psak came out that way. And why don't you go ask Rabbi so-and-so, who I think will paskin that way. Right, that's the position that he's arguing for is that after you reach the end of the formal halachic process, you say that means that I can't make the decision, but I can tell you which way I think the decision should be made, and I'm willing to tell you that there is so and so to whom you can ask that decision, right? To whom you can ask, and they will make that decision for you. Now, there is an entirely different model you could use, which is to say, well, guess what? The halachic authority reached a stalemate, so we have here is a safek. Right? Safek is a formal halachic category of doubt, and there are rules about how you handle safek. Right? Biblical safekot go stringently, rabbinic safekot go leniently, and you leave, right? And there's no reason that the issue should ever leave the realm of formal halacha that way. But Rabbi Linzer opens up the possibility that when we declare a halachic stalemate, we say, you know what, what's left, right, halachic stalemates don't leave you at a formally frozen position. Halachic stalemates leave you needing other factors to make the decision. And for him, the other factors are morality, and it seems to him pretty clear that rabbis really should tell people that's the right thing to do, even though I can't paskin it for you, which is an interesting notion, right? That's the right thing to do, but I can't paskin it for you, and you should do the right thing. And if you're not willing to do the right thing yourself, just like I'm not willing to tell you the right thing, why don't you go to Rabbi so-and-so and he'll tell you the right thing to do? Right? That's a really interesting position to take, which sets a limit on halakhic authority. Right? At some point, halakhic authority, you can set up a model, you can extend this model all you want and say, you know what, at the extreme version of this model, anytime you have a posek who says, right, anytime you have a dispute among poskim, so which makes it legitimate to handle either side, so individuals can do whatever they want. And why all you need is a formal basis for what you're doing, and if you can formally justify what you're doing, that is the limit of halakha. Right, that I think is the position Rabbi Linzer articulated. Well, I want to argue that it's not, right, Rabbi Linzer could have said, this is my psak, I think that you all should follow my psak. I don't think the reason he didn't do that was cowardice. I think that he has a principled objection to telling people they ought to do something because he paskin that way, as opposed to making up their mind that he's right. But I think that he believed that deciding this issue on purely formal criteria, when you should recognize that the moral weight is all one side, that would be improper. That would be improper cowardice. So what he ends up.
What would be moral weight? I don't know. Where's this morality coming from?
So he believes, right? And again, I'm not endorsing this position. I'm right, describing it, right? Because my own position on brain death is right is not this at all. But he believes that the moral weight of saving the lives of the patients who are not brain dead outweighs the possibility, the halachic possibility if people aren't halachically dead yet, and therefore he believed the moral argument was all in favor of allowing transplants from brain dead patients. Now again, I don't want to debate the substance of it. Right, the substance of it I discussed elsewhere. I'm just saying that what's interesting to me about the halachic process is that he was allowing that he allowed that as a factor post the halachic process. Right? The halachic process reaches a point where there's authority on both sides, and at that point we say, as opposed to saying, so you're frozen, and all you can do is do nothing, or pick a posik, right, whoever your normal posik is, right, pick whoever your standard posik is, whoever your, right, whoever you normally ask your shayla to, you should ask this shayla to also. What he said is, no, you should find a way to make the decision that you believe is correct. And rabbis who don't feel they have the shoulders to paskin should find a way to empower their ladies to make the decision they believe is correct. That's a radically decentralized notion, as I say, to take it to an extreme. I don't think Rabbi Linzer would, but I think it follows logically, right, ends up saying that any position which has sufficient halachic weight to be, where you can say it is a halachically operational definition, right, creates complete autonomy.
I didn't mean to quip with, you know, autonomy versus cowardice. I'm just wondering whether this is a really authentic notion of autonomy or an inauthentic notion. Because one could imagine that real autonomy would let me give another model.
Right.
That you, the Haredi tradition is abject dependence and pure heteronomy. You could imagine a position in which the role of a posek is to strengthen the knowledge base of Balabhadra to be able to make their own decisions in a certain way, but only through apprenticing themselves sufficiently to halakha so they can make an informed decision. This that Linzer is suggesting is not giving his Balabhadra an informed decision base. I mean, they're not making an informed decision. It's really a crapshoot. Now, ignorant people who don't know what to do are being guided by some other kind of emotional argument here that's not sufficiently halakhically grounded, and hopefully they'll come out in the right way because he's shoving them in a certain direction.
We'll talk about the Haredi critique in a minute. First of all, to be fair to Rabbi Linzer, he doesn't actually talk about lay people at all. Right? His position is that, right, talking about rabbis who are insufficiently educated to make the decision. I think the argument is extensible, and that's the risk. Right? The question is, once you allow a model which says in principle that the that after a halachic stalemate, right, values considerations can enter into it, right? So that in principle, right, means that somebody can say, well, you know what, I don't need to know the halakha because halakha reached a stalemate, and now I can make up my own mind. Now, I know personally that I don't think he would want it to go that far, but I think that it sets out ideologically one model you can have, which is a very risky model. Now, the last line of his petition that was also really important. What he said is to adopt a restrictive position regarding donating organs and a permissive position regarding receiving organs is morally untenable. And such an approach is also highly damaging to the state of Israel, both internally in regards to its relationship with the larger world and to the Jewish people as a whole. This approach must be unequivocally rejected by Jews at the individual and the communal level. Now, that was what I think the first statement Agudah probably would have just said, wow, that's really fancy and not have noticed it. The last paragraph. Right, the last paragraph set it off. Right? So here's what Agudah said about this. Right? The recent, quote, rabbinic statement regarding organ donations and brain death, signed by several score, quote, Orthodox rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva. Right? The second statement, you'll see the second paragraph begins, the statement signed by congregational and campus rabbis and chaplains. Right, not Orthodox rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva, which was ridiculous, because, at least it's Rosh Yeshiva, you don't like his yeshiva, but it's Rosh Yeshiva. And many Israeli rabbis signed it also. It was unjustified cheap shotting. But, right, what it began by saying, but if you can ignore the offensive rhetoric, there's interesting substance in this piece. Right, if it says, right, that it makes a mockery of halachic process by asking other rabbis to accept a particular halachic view regarding a complex issue pertaining to matters of life and death on the ground that the times require a certain result. Okay? Then he quotes the second paragraph, and it says, for anyone, rabbi or layman, to decide that a perceived outcome should determine what halachic approach to take is something usually associated with Jewish movements outside of Orthodoxy. So we really don't want to make this non-Orthodoxy because it's going to get us tarred as non-Orthodox. Right? Compounding the statement's offensive embrace of a halachic position based on an extra-halachic rationale is the derision of those who take a restrictive position regarding donating organs and a permissive position regarding receiving organs, those people who say you can't donate but you can receive. Right, that halachic position, held by a majority of major poskim today, is derided by the statement as morally untenable and must thus be unequivocally rejected by Jews at the individual and the communal level. No! What must be unequivocally rejected by Jews, at least those who care for the honor of Torah, are attempts to manufacture halachot and personal specifications and the disparagement of true halachic authorities. Okay, all right, so the battle lines got drawn pretty starkly. And they got drawn, really, on two levels, right, which really turn out to be one. Right, the extreme level is the notion that can one ever call a formally legitimate halachic position immoral? Right, where Rabbi Linzer was willing to say, you know what, there are two, right, I know perfectly well there are major poskim who say this, and it's morally untenable. I think he was willing to say that. You can find a way to bridge the positions by saying that the poskim had said it in individual cases, but nobody had ruled out of the community, but in practice, there were certainly major poskim in Israel who ruled that it was permitted to take organs, but not to donate them. And Rabbi Linzer, right, said that all Jews, unequivocally, individually, right, meaning whether you are deeply learned or not, needs to reject this position unequivocally. Right, to say that there is a formally legitimate halachic position which is morally untenable. There, Agudah went wild because it said, who are these people to judge great poskim?
And then also, what is moral? Where does that set of moral value
absolutely
come from?
And underlying that, was the second critique, which said that that to claim that in an issue on which the formal halachic criteria are exhausted, that non-halachic factors have a role to play, right? That means perhaps that lay people have a role to play. What's that doing here? Right, halacha is an area of experts, and why should the values of lay people matter? Really, only the values of Gedolei HaPoskim should matter. Now, here's what I want to do to complicate this, and then we'll put it together and we'll close. The rhetoric of this Agudah statement is taken almost word for word from unorthodoxy. There has, traditionally, Haredi Psak was perfectly open to the imposition of values, and it was only modern orthodoxy built up some very, very peculiar lectures of the Rav that took the notion that halakha was an autonomous system which was utterly impervious to values. Right, so that's one really interesting thing here, where really the Agudah statement comes out of halakhic man, and a religious statement is really traditional psak in some ways. And I have to say, personal relationship to this, the story I tell frequently that was my introduction to serious psak was Rabbi Mordechai Willig, my teacher, coming into Shir when I was a freshman in college, and telling us a story in which he was asked to Shaila about a Tay-Sachs abortion. Right, a couple came to him, and they had a baby who had been diagnosed in utero with Tay-Sachs, and they wanted to know if they could abort. And Willig looked at us in Shir, and he said, well, you know what? Rav Moshe says it's Usher. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg says it's Mutter. Who am I to decide? Who am I to decide between Rav Moshe and the Tzitzeliezer? So I sent him to ask the Tzitzeliezer. So that was my masorah, right? You know, this is not the notion that you pass the shaila on to somebody who can decide it in the way that you believe is the right answer. Whether I think that was the right answer or not is a different question, right? But the notion that that's a viable halachic decision is something that I have you don't have to go to Yeshiva Chovei Torah to find that, you know, in the heart of YU. You can find that as a classic model of halachic decision making. The problem is, right, as Rabbi Sender articulates, is that we don't really, right, we have a suspicion, I think a legitimate suspicion, of an absolute democracy in which Torah knowledge doesn't privilege you in the conversation about values at all. Right, Torah knowledge only privileges you in the conversation about formal halacha. That's the end game. The other way is say, you know what, halakha is a game. Right, the game is played. The game reaches an outcome. If the outcome is indecisive, so then we move into a different field where we say, you know what, you don't have to play 5-on-5 basketball anymore. You just have to hit foul shots. Right, and then we can bring in people who can't play basketball at all. They just shoot foul shots and they can win shootouts, whatever. Right, in soccer, right, basketball hasn't degenerated to that yet. So that really is, I think, a core tension. Where on the one hand, I think that one difference between modern orthodoxy and Haredi Psak is that there is a much more of a willingness, and I think this is both descriptive and certainly, I say it prescriptively, a willingness to recognize the importance of values in decision making, and the recognition that people can be great, great Talmud scholars and great halachic scholars and still make really serious moral errors, and that people should, right, and that everyone, you know, has a responsibility that we live in a post Nuremberg culture, right, in which we don't want people halachically to justify immoral actions on the grounds that I was following orders. And on the other hand, right, and that I think comes from this notion of autonomy doesn't just mean freedom, it means responsibility. Right, the notion that you are responsible for your own decisions, and it's not legitimate to say, I did this wrong thing because my rabbi told me to. And on the other hand, if having a really good Torah education doesn't privilege you in the values discourse, so what's the point? If all that Torah scholarship does is enable you to play a game better, right? So there's a character in Chaim Grada's novel The Aguna, who's a young prodigy who serves on a Beit Din, and the vicious satire is whenever somebody walks into his Beit Din, all he cares about is, does that person know more than him or less than him? The person knows more than him, he's upset. If the person knows less than him, he ignores him. Right? Because that's his whole goal, is just to establish his superiority in the game. That can't be. So what I want to set out is that I think that a modern orthodox halachic process is going to be one in which we don't have it as an absolute level, in which we say that the person with the highest level of Torah knowledge automatically gets all the values right, and therefore nobody ever has any right to argue with them, and basically, and it's always, it's like playing Stratego, right? When two people meet and they have a dispute about what to do, so the person with the higher level of Torah knowledge wins, right? And that's it. And you get, right, you're off the board, yeah, right? If you're an 8 and they're a 9, right? That's a new stratego. The old stratego is lower number 1, right? But it's just a zero sum game. And there's really no and the ideal world would be one in which nobody had autonomy. Everybody got to do exactly what the greatest Torah scholar in the world told them. Because practically they don't have time, so sometimes they have to delegate. And we could say this as a vision between as the controversy in Moshe and Yehoshua. Right? Is it a threat to authority if there are other people going around being Nevi'im? Or me saying Vayakol Am Hashem Nevi'im? Or should we really want everybody in principle to have access to God? So I want to suggest that the development of monorethic halachic process is going to be one, or at least one model for it, is one in which we try to maximize the extent to which people live in accordance with their values on the premise that living in accordance with their values has to be within the framework of Torah, and that, as in all political systems, the right to live within your values also has to play within the context of making a society possible. Now, how you navigate those rules, right? And say what it means to how we determine that, right? What constitutes a sufficient education on what kind of issues that people get to play it, right? That the goal should be to empower people to make their own decisions locally, right? You ask me this question, well, look, let's look at the sources together and let's see if we can do that. Let's read the following articles. Or this is something that, you know what, I could give you all the articles you want, but it really takes judgment. It really takes experience, right? What those boundaries are, I think, is a very hard thing. It takes a lot of work to figure out, particularly as we get, as we have different kinds of knowledge that, never existed before, where you have lay people who never studied formally but know Shas by heart because they've been to Daf Yomi Shir listening to art school, right? No one that never existed before. To have lay people who knew Shas by heart but never actually learned Gemara in an intense fashion, or an environment in which you can search the web and you can and people with good web searching skills can know more than most of the rabbis within 10 minutes, right? Because they've read 3 articles which clearly explain in English what all the sources are, right? So we haven't figured out what constitutes the kind of knowledge that lets you make what kind of decisions when. But I tend to think that the process we develop should be much more built around working on the presumption that once the community is viable, our goal is to enable people to live the lives that express their own Tzel Melukim as much as possible within the framework of halakha, that is willing to, in a sense, sacrifice the notion of having every decision made by the best person to the value of having every decision made by the person for themselves. Right. Those are extremes. There's going to be a ground in the middle. I think that will over time develop a distinctive body and approach, not so much in what the answers are or how you analyze the sources, but in what happens when you're asked the question and what kind of outcome do you want to reach. Right? Is your goal always to reach the outcome which provides maximum clarity and uniformity for everybody? Or is your goal to reach an outcome which provides maximum empowerment for people? I tend to think that's where we would go. That is unquestionably a prescriptive vision. I think that it is descriptively true that you're much more likely to get that kind of answer from a monorthodox posik than from a Haredi posik. But if that's going to be the truth, then there's a long way to go yet. Thank you very much for listening to my attempt to construct it.
Yeah. You have time for questions.
I have time for questions that people want to say. All right. Let's mark it here first. Yes.
So, in regard to the content of this conference, it's not clear to me why saving a life is considered a
okay, good. So
okay, here's the luck position and we're bringing this outside value. It doesn't seem like that's just how you weigh them.
That's true. I critiqued a religious position as cheating. It was double counting. Right, that really I think that value is a part of halachic decision making, right? One of the bases, one of the grounds on which you decide whether to paskin like the Tzitz Eliezer or Rav Moshe is that you think that morally the Tzitz Eliezer position is superior, right? And if you hit a deadlock, right? The deadlock isn't just a formal game. The deadlock means that counting the moral issues, you still have a deadlock, and then to double count them is cheating. Right? I think that's the right. That's what you're saying is right. It's not. Why do these factors, you're saying, is why is it an extra halachic factor? And what I'm saying is, why is it only brought in afterwards?
Well, okay. Right. So somehow I got the impression that there's an approach here that's like a mathematical proof. It's not a method to get from A to B to C to D. Whatever S says, that's your specimen, even if it doesn't make that sense. That's one approach. It's going
right
to get to S, and then you say, well, this doesn't make sense considering all these other halachic principles, let's reconsider. And that seems to be Wilder's approach here.
So you think that he's just playing halachic factors out. So what the reason to me I don't think that's true is that he tells you, right, you know, he doesn't tell you this is the halachic outcome. Right, he goes out of his way to tell you that even though, right, there is no formal halachic way to say this, or you don't feel there's a halachic way to say this, you should still do this. So he's calling it extra, right, he's calling it something that happens after the formal process is concluded. Well, he could have paskined, and he could have told everybody to paskin that way. He doesn't, right? He says, I understand that some of you can't paskin this way, and I still think you should do this. Right? So you might argue that the real critique of him, right, and this is Rabbi Sender's critique, is, no, you should have the strength to take your own position. Right? Just say, this, I think, is the psak, and everybody ought to paskin this way. Right? But I think that, I'm projecting, and, you know, if somebody will listen to this and email me that I got it all wrong. Although I did email him the written version of this. He didn't respond telling me I was wrong. He didn't respond telling me I was right either. So I can't tell you. Sometimes he responds. That one he didn't. But I think that he's very strongly committed to the notion that people, you know, that it's not preferable for people to do things under authority. And that, furthermore, for him to claim they should do it under his authority runs into the issue why his authority is opposed to somebody else's. So he doesn't think that authority is a model by which he can get that. So the only, right, but he recognizes that if he can't paskin it for them, so on what basis is, right, are his students paskining it? Right. So I might argue that, you know, that his job is to just say I paskin this way. You have the right to follow me. Right, that might be a better model, but I think he was very clearly not doing that. Partially because he didn't want to just limit it to his students. I don't think, you know, it's just a pragmatic calculation that if he had tried it that way, he would have limited the reach to his students alone, and that, right, that wouldn't have had the kind of broader reach that he wanted. Okay, yes.
I think that it seems a little bit dangerous when you go to your rabbi and you rabbi and you give you the right decision. On the place shopping for the answers, a little bit on the dangerous side.
Sure it is. Absolutely, right, absolutely it is. Right, those are the, you know, on one hand you call it rabbi shopping. And this is a big issue, right? Because why should anybody ask a question when you, right, if you only know the answer? This is, yeah, the place where this became clearest to me was birth control. So, right, so for years, people would, right, I had students who would call me and say, "I want to ask the birth control shaila. Which of these rabbis will give me this answer?" Right, and then eventually they would call me and say, "What am I doing? Right? Why am I asking a shaila? Right? If I'm only willing to ask a shaila to the rabbi who will give me the answer." On the other hand, if you ask that shaila to the wrong rabbi, disaster ensues. Right? I know of one case, you know, where somebody entirely innocently asked the birth control shaila to a rabbi who had a completely different vision of what the role of women in the world was than her own, which she didn't understand, and so she got an answer which from her perspective was totally disastrous. Basically got a Catholic answer. So I think that's one of the real challenges. It's one useful model is they always ask the same rabbi, right? But on the other hand, there have to be limits. And also we live in an era which is somewhat problematic, not so much Baruch Hashem in this community, but where we have specialized poskim. And I don't know that that's necessarily such a loss. Like, I think that if you have a complicated nida shaila, it's not unreasonable to call Rabbi Sabalovsky. And if you call me, the odds are, you know, 9-1. But all I'll do is I'll call Rabbi Sabalovsky. If he's available, right? I might call Rabbi Jafter first, right? And if it's complicated, Rabbi Jafter will tell me to call Rabbi Sabalovsky. you know, and they're a specialist, right? And that's, you know, Nida and Nikva, he's great. I don't know about the other issues. I've only heard him on those issues. On those issues, he's just great. And, you know, and whereas, you know, some other issues, I might not agree with him entirely. And so it might be that there are poskim who have instincts that are terrific on these issues and, right, and less terrific on other issues. You know, some of us have, you know, what do we do with poskim who are really, really good at solving mamzerut issues? Right? You come to them, you come with a mamzerut issue, and you know for sure that in fact, you know, that any mamzer, anyone who walks into that right into that rabbi's house, a mamzer walks out kosher to marry somebody. But that same rabbi is also perfectly happy to, let's say that, you know, why should you see an issue with Jews receiving organs but not donating them? After all, we're the chosen people. Right. So what do you, right? So what do you do? What do you do with that? Do you say that, you know, that in order to accept somebody as a posik, you have to agree with all their ethical positions? You have to find all their ethical positions morally tenable. Right. That's a complicated thing. Once you impose responsibility on people to have any kind of moral judgment, then you run that. And the question is how we, with integrity, say you're submitting to the halachic process, which requires asking shalos to people without knowing the answers, and to some degree accepting authority. With responsibility, I don't know if we have a good answer to that yet. You know, I have, let's say, there's one post-it I won't quote, period. You know, except under extremists. I don't care how good a Talmud Chacham he is. He says too many things that, you know, that so upset me morally that I, you know, I won't put him on my Makorot sheets. If I have any choice at all, I won't quote him. Because I don't want to give him halachic authority. But that's an extreme case. Most of the time there are things where I'd say, you know, you should call him because he's the best postic in the world, and right. And on the other hand, there are other issues where if he told you to do it, right, do it. I would say no. Right, it's morally untenable. You can't do that. And once I'm telling you that, right, so then I'm giving authority to you in ways that, right, don't just let you ask me all the questions. Unless you just trust me all the way, right? But you know, you can feel, but you might feel the same way about me, that I'm good at some things, and really awful at others. On brain death, for example, I have, you know, dear friends who ask me lots of shilohs who have written that my own position about brain death is morally untenable and horrific. Right, this is awful stuff, I think. A dear friend of mine wrote, right, this is awful stuff, unquote. right? So, you know, that person, you know, generally that person has fine respect for my moral judgment, but they would think that following my psak was, you know, I think they think it's murder. So, you know, I don't know if there's a way, but there's a way around it. I think it's always a question whether modern Orthodoxy is an elite position, not just intellectually, but morally. And that modern, I think that one of the things that communally, right, is going to distinguish modern Orthodoxy is the moral responsibility of the laity. And the challenge is, can we build a morally responsible laity which nonetheless accepts halachic authority? I like to think we can. Listen, do you want to say something?
That's such a nice place to end.
Oh. All right. Thank you very much. Hopefully we'll see you next week.
Very interesting position.